From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
You can tell you've created God in your own image when he hates all the same people you do. You know, the opposite of faith is not doubt, it's certainty. I think it's the scariest position to be in, is to be sure that you're right.
That's Anne Lamott, author of several best-selling books on spirituality. Today she'll tell us about her own, rather quirky, search for God. Also, renowned historian Elaine Pagels on the newly discovered Gospel of Judas.
The Gospel of Judas is a kind of protest literature. It's challenging leaders of the church and saying, you know, when you encourage young people to go out there and die for God, you're really complicit in murder.
And can hip-hop and Islam coexist? Meet Lupe Fiasco.
I'm not a Muslim rapper. You know, I'm a rapper who happens to be Muslim. I don't walk around with a kufi. I don't grow my beard all the way out. I don't constantly just put it in your face because I don't want to be looked at as the poster boy for Islam.
But first, how's your basic knowledge of religion? To find out, it's time to play 7 questions. Question number 1. What are the first 5 books of the Hebrew Bible or the Christian Old Testament? 2. Can you name the 10 Commandments? Okay, I didn't really give you enough time, but hey, airtime is precious. 3. What are the 4 noble truths of Buddhism? 4. You've heard the saying, God helps those who help themselves. Is this in the Bible? If so, where? Number 5. What are the 7 sacraments of Catholicism? 6. Can you name 1 of the sacred texts of Hinduism? And your final question. George W. Bush spoke in his first inaugural address of the Jericho Road. What Bible story was he referring to? Well, how'd you do? If those questions gave you trouble, you're not alone. Most of Stephen Prothero's students at Boston University flunk his religious literacy quiz. And Prothero thinks that's a real problem. So he's written a book called Religious Literacy, What Every American Needs to Know and Doesn't. He says it's imperative that we have a working knowledge of religion, at home and abroad.
At home, we've got religion becoming increasingly important in the political space now that Democrats have discovered religion alongside Republicans. So it's really hard to follow what's happening with debates about abortion or stem cell research or even the environment or gay marriage, certainly, if you don't know something about the arguments that politicians are making religiously. And overseas, of course, I think the argument's even more compelling, which is how can you understand Iran or Iraq without knowing something about Islam? How can you understand a hot spot like Kashmir, which happily has not erupted yet, but it may, without knowing something about Hinduism in India and Islam in Pakistan?
But what about people who really don't want to have anything to do with religion? They aren't religious themselves. They don't think that religion should be a part of the discussion. Why do they need religious literacy?
Well, being religious has absolutely zero to do with my proposition. You know, that's like saying, oh, I'm not religious or I'm not a Muslim, so I don't have to understand anything about Islam to understand the Middle East. Well, that's just absurd on the face of it. I mean, for me, the really important thing that we need to know about Islam that we clearly didn't know as a nation when we went into Iraq is that Sunnis and Shiites hate each other, and that being a Sunni and a Shiite is not like being a Baptist and a Methodist in Georgia. You know, it's not like they're going to get together and, you know, bake pies in the afternoon and raise money for their local Habitat for Humanity shelter. I mean, these are communities that really fundamentally disagree in the way that Protestants and Catholics used to disagree in the Middle Ages. And we didn't know that. Our president didn't know that. Our Secretary of Defense and State didn't know that. And I think it's criminal that we didn't know that. And I think as long as we continue to educate young people in a way that we do now, which is as if religion doesn't matter, then we're going to keep raising up politicians like this who are unable to deal with the international realities that we live in.
Do you really think that American foreign policy after 9/11 would have been different had there been a higher standard of religious literacy?
Yes, I do. I think before 9/11, it would have been different, too. I mean, Madeleine Albright has talked about this, Bill Clinton's former Secretary of State. She talked about how when she was the Secretary of State, she had dozens and dozens of economic experts at her fingertips. and she had one informal friend who was helping her out with religion. What that's saying is that people are motivated to act overseas purely on the basis of economic motivations. And that's just not true. If you want to pursue our national interests as Americans, you need to understand what motivates people to act. And what motivates people to act, more than I think, or at least as much as economic realities and political realities, is religious realities. And so we're just burying our head in the sand if we imagine that, oh, we can understand Iraq and Iran by thinking about them as socioeconomic spaces. That's just not true. You can't understand Iran and the current president without knowing something about charisma and Islamic leadership.
So how far back do you need to go? Do we need to begin studying religion in high school? Do we need to revive the Sunday school as a part and parcel of every American child's education? Do we start in elementary school? Do we bring religion back into the schools, which is, of course, different from bringing faith into the schools?
Right. Well, the focus of my religious literacy book is definitely on the public schools rather than on religious institutions. I think that religious institutions are either training or failing to train young people for religious purposes, and that's a different project from what I'm talking about. Some people do sometimes say to me, oh, this should be done in the Sunday schools, and I'll say, well, it's not, for one. And secondarily, in the Sunday schools, you might learn about Methodism, but you're not going to learn about Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam, which we need for our kids. So my focus is definitely on the public schools, and I think we need two courses. I think we need a world religions course that could take place in 8th grade or 9th grade or 10th grade, and then I think we need a Bible course later on in high school so people can understand the history of American literature, the history of Western art, and very importantly, contemporary American politics, because it's the Bible that's the scripture of American politics in terms of the arguments that politicians nowadays make in this country.
But how do you do that when the emphasis has been so strongly on keeping religion out of the schools?
Well, I'm not interested in putting religion back in the schools because I make a distinction you just made, between teaching about religion and preaching about religion, between doing religion and studying religion. It's the same as if you look at art and art history. You can be a great artist and not know anything about the history of art. You can be a wonderful art historian and not be able to draw a stick figure. Same with religion. It's one thing to be faithful. It's one thing to go to church. It's another thing to understand something about Christianity or to understand something about other religions. So I'm talking about putting religious studies in the public schools, not putting religion in the public schools. That said, the people who are opposing my project here are really of two types. There's the sort of the crackpot religious right people and the crackpot secular left people. Those are very small groups. You know, the kinds of fundamentalists, Christians, who want to keep their kids in willful ignorance, they do exist, but they're relatively small. And, you know, the vast overwhelming majority of evangelicals in the United States, you know, don't think that way. They think, you know, that we believe the Bible is true, but we also understand that it can be studied historically and talked about as a form of literature. And the same with people who are agnostics and atheists. You know, there are some on the way left who are going to say, you know, the word religion and the word God should never be uttered in a public school. And that's just silly, and you can't get that out of First Amendment jurisprudence, but they'll say it nonetheless. So those are the two groups that are opposing me, and they're pretty small, and I think the vast majority of Americans are in the middle.
What happens when schools decide to do this? I mean, I read recently Harvard talked about requiring all the undergraduates to take a course called Reason and Faith, and there was a lot of criticism of them for doing that, and I think eventually they backed down, didn't they?
Yeah, Harvard dropped the ball. I hope Boston University, my university, will pick up the ball and we can lead on this rather than having Harvard lead. Harvard listened to scientists who are afraid of religion, who think that we should keep even Harvard undergraduates in ignorance about the religions of the world because they think religion is somehow scary and anti-scientific and unreasonable. I guess they want everybody in the world to sort of think like them. And unfortunately, the world isn't that way. Or I should say, fortunately, not everybody in the world thinks like a Harvard professor. You know, we need to know at the college level, we graduate students every year who don't know basic information, who can't even name the five or seven great religions of the world. Again, I think that's a scandal, and I think that's something that colleges and universities need to address.
But that's a pretty broad criticism. I had read in some of the response to the Harvard proposal, Steven Pinker said that what he was concerned about was the idea of discussing faith and reason as equivalent ways of knowing. That comes back to this question that I know is important to you, of distinguishing between the study of religion and the belief in religion. But it's a very difficult thing to keep them separate in most people's minds, don't you think?
Yeah, and including in the mind of Steven Pinker. I mean, I think it shows that you can be a very smart person and be very dumb when it comes to religion. I think that Professor Pinker and a lot of the other critics of this Harvard proposal at Harvard, just they don't get it. I mean, if you call something faith and reason, you know, there's an and in the middle, and usually things joined by and are different from one another. Otherwise, you don't need the and. So faith and reason are two different things. Too many scientists, I think about religion as if it's sort of bad reason. You know, there's sort of the reasonable way to think, and then there's the unreasonable way, and the unreasonable way is the religious way. And so therefore, we don't need to teach young people the unreasonable way of thinking. That's their sort of irrational thought process. You know, my thought process is that people around the world throughout history have thought and acted politically, socially, economically, culturally, because of the religious things that they believe and do. And we can either understand those religious things and therefore understand what they do, or we can ignore them and we can pretend and wish that they were different. And so I think that Harvard is going to continue allowing students to graduate without knowing anything about what I think is the most powerful cultural force in the world. And I'm hopeful that gradually some universities, maybe even my own, will start to require that that kind of ignorance not be allowed among the holders of bachelor's degrees.
Some of the criticism, it seems to me, must be based in fear. We've seen so many examples of religion being used to bludgeon its opponents. And the fear, I suspect, is that once you begin to teach religion in public schools, the danger of those who teach it proselytizing about one sect or another grows. How do you make sure that isn't going to happen?
Well, I actually think that we are ill-equipped and disempowered to put religious bullies in their place as long as we're ignorant about religion. In other words, you need to say, you know, you're telling me that the Bible is opposed to Roe v. Wade. Where does the Bible say that? And so religious demagogues, I think, have more power in a country of people who are religiously illiterate than they would in a country with people who are religiously literate. I think that's one of the ironies of, you know, critics of learning about religion. As to the broader question, which to me is more important, how do you teach about religion in the public schools without having the teachers proselytize? I think that's a really fair and a really important question. And the most basic thing is you have to teach them the difference between preaching religion and teaching about religion. That's really important. They need to know something about what the Supreme Court says about what's allowed and what isn't allowed, which is pretty basic. What's allowed is teaching students about the history of religion, scriptures, etc., and what's not allowed is trying to get them to accept Jesus as their Savior and Lord or trying to convert to Islam.
Stephen Prothrow. He chairs the religion department at Boston University. His book is called Religious Literacy, What Every American Needs to Know and Doesn't.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dedicated to my grandmother. Peace and much love to you.
You're listening to the introduction to Lupe Fiasco's debut rap album. If this doesn't sound like rap to you, then, well, neither will the lyrics. The opening lines are an Islamic prayer in Arabic, roughly translated as, "I seek refuge from Satan in the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful." Not exactly your standard hip-hop song. Lupe Fiasco is a devout Muslim. He says his album's title, Food and Liquor, refers to the Islamic principle of halal, or that which is permitted, and haram, that which is forbidden. The album was number one on the rap album charts and landed Lupe Fiasco 3 Grammy Award nominations. And Strange Champs asked Lupe Fiasco why he started his album with a prayer.
Like, I'm not the most knowledgeable scholar of Islam, even though I was born Muslim. But normally when I'm around like a group of, like we went to a class called Talim, you go to study about Islam. Mm-hmm. Whenever they open the class, they will open it up with Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Well, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. And it was just kind of to bless the situation to, you know, God forgive me for anything that I say that might be misleading within these proceedings, what have you. So it's kind of just to give praise, do everything. Every time you wake up, you know, you're supposed to invoke God. You know, everything you do, you're supposed to invoke a higher power. And that's basically what it was. And I figured, you know, my album's going to be pressed up 100 million times and what have you. So I might as well, every time somebody plays it, I want them to, you know, invoke God as well.
Do you think hearing that at the beginning of the album would affect how people hear the whole album? I mean, does it, do you think, kind of put your music in a different space, in a different context?
I don't know. I don't know how every individual person takes that. Like, this is actually the first interview where that was, like, one of the first two questions. Hmm. Where it was like, why did you open it up with Bismillah Rahman Rahim? So I don't know. I don't know if people would just, like, you know, they don't bring it up. Even my fans, you know, some of the Muslim fans do. But a majority of the fans, it kind of goes over their head.
So is your being Muslim and a hip-hop artist, do most people not really pay attention to that?
Yeah, I think because I don't wear it on my sleeve. You know, I'm not a Muslim rapper. You know, I'm a rapper who happens to be Muslim. I don't walk around with a kufi. I don't roll my beard all the way out. You know, I don't constantly just put it in your face. It's very intentional because I don't want to be looked at as the poster boy for Islam because I also have my flaws and shortcomings, you know, and some of those are public. And I don't want people to relate my flaws and shortcomings to the shortcomings and flaws of Islam. You know, I don't want to make it that easy, you know, for the enemies of Islam to be like, oh, well, just look at Lupe. You know, he has a girlfriend and he's not married and that, you know, and I don't want them to use those little things, you know, as weapons against Islam.
Abraham talked, Muhammad talked, and Moses split the sea. I ain't trying to profit off the prophet, so this one here's free. G's up, along with Muhammad and Jesus. In the Quran, they call him Isa. Don't think Osama and Saddam is our leader. We pray for peace, but the drama intrigues us.
You're a star now. Your debut album last year was number one on the charts. You've gotten three Grammy nominations. Your fame is growing. I'm sure you get invited to lots of parties, you know, where there's probably liquor, drugs, groupies. What do you do in the situations like that?
You run as fast as you can.
Yeah, right.
Nah, you can control it. It's not as seamless as people think. Like, you get into a limo and every limo pulls up to the front of a party. It's not like that. You definitely control your destiny in any business, especially in the music business. So it's not as easy to get caught up in the lifestyle as people think. Like, you definitely have to tell yourself, like, it's 11 o'clock. I can either go to sleep or I can go to the porno star party in the hills of Hollywood. You know, so it's like, what am I going to do? Maybe I'm going to just go to sleep. It's a struggle. Everybody struggles, though.
You can hear that tension in some of your songs. I mean, I'm thinking about the song Hurt Me So. That sort of seems like it's your plea to the hip-hop industry. I mean, you're sort of singing, this is the music I love, and you're singing this music, and yet you're saying it hurts me.
Yeah, it does. Jay-Z's the executive producer of my album. You know, we're good friends. I was a big, big fan of Jay-Z when I was a little kid. Jay-Z had a song. It was called The Evils. And on the song, he said he never prayed to God. He prayed to God-E. I ain't asking for forgiveness for my sins. And I remember I boycotted Jay-Z. I was like, I'll never listen to Jay-Z ever. Like, at that time, Islam was very heavy. And I was rapping, but it was like, I can't listen to that. You know, I can't listen to somebody saying that they never prayed to God. That's not good. But it turns out he's my executive producer, you know, on my album. And I even stated on the album, like, I had a ghetto boy bop, a Jay-Z boycott, because he said he never prayed to God. He prayed to God-E. I'm thinking godly, God me from the ungodly. But by my 30th watching, the streets is watching, I was back to giving props again. And that was bothering, about as uncomfortable as an untouchable touching you. Streets is watching was a video that he had put out about his second album. And it was like he shot a video for every song on the album. And it was the most entertaining piece of hip hop cinema ever made. You know, and I've watched it about 60 times. The images in there are just vivid misogyny and the worst of the worst. But it was like, with all that and all my morals, it was still my favorite movie.
It's so interesting to hear you say that, because you're performing in the context of the hip-hop culture, the hip-hop industry, which is famous for its misogyny and for seeing women completely differently. Has that been a problem for you?
No, not really. I say that in the song. I used to hate hip-hop because the women degraded. But Too Short made me laugh. Like a hypocrite, I played it. A hypocrite, I stated, though I only recited half. Omitting the word bitch, cursing I wouldn't say it. Me and dog couldn't relate until a bitch I dated. So I understand where it comes from. I can understand the concept of pimps and hoes and things of that nature. Because it's a real concept. There's really hoes and there's really pimps. And it's real. If there was no rap music, you know, there would still be hoes and there would still be pimps and there would still be the actual events and things that inspire these records. You know, they would still take place and they would still be there. Some of my vivid memories are looking at half-naked prostitutes on my corner when I was a little kid, when I was 6 years old. You know, flashing cars that would go by. And that's not a video. That's not in a rap record. That was like a woman flashing herself in broad daylight in front of some little kids.
Check it out. Now I ain't trying to be the greatest. I used to hate hip-hop. Yep, because the women degraded, but too short made me laugh. Like a hypocrite, I played it. A hypocrite, I stated, though I only recited half. Omitting the word bitch, cursing, I wouldn't say it. Me and dog couldn't relate till the bitch I dated. Forgive my favorite word for hers and hers alike, but I learned it from a song I heard and sorta liked. Yeah, further ice and glamorized drug dealing was appealing, but the block club kept it from in front of our building. Gangsta rap based filmings became the building blocks for children with leaking ceilings, catching drip with pots, coupled with compositions from Pac, Nas as it was written in the mix with my realities and feelings, living conditions, religion, ignorant wisdom, and artistic vision. I began to jot, tap the world and listen, it dropped. My mom can't feed me, my boyfriend beats me, I have sex for money, the hood don't love me, the cops wanna kill me, this nonsense built me, and I got no place to go. They bomb my village, they call us killers, took me off their welfare, can't afford their health. My teacher won't teach me, my master beats me, and it hurts me.
I had a ghetto boy bop a Jay-Z boycott, cause he said that he never prayed to God, he prayed to God. I'm thinking godly, godly.
Your album begins with a prayer. I was wondering, is there a way in which you could say that the whole album is a prayer?
It may be, you know, you get a 60-minute album, and maybe one line in that 60-minute album is something that I'm expressing, or a prayer, or something to God to, like, please save us, please help us, please help me become a better person, please help me become a better example. If I don't sell a million records, that's what I want to be remembered for. I don't want to be remembered for any scandal or any riches or fame or how good of an MC I was or anything like that. I want to be remembered as Uwe Fiasco didn't lead us astray.
Daydream.
Dream.
I fell asleep beneath the flowers.
I fell asleep beneath the flowers.
For a couple of hours.
For a couple of hours.
On a beautiful day.
On a beautiful day.
Daydream.
Daydream.
I dream of you beneath the flowers.
I dream of you beneath the flowers.
For a couple of hours.
For a couple of hours.
Such a beautiful day.
Such a beautiful
day. Now come on everybody, let's make cocaine cool. We need a few more half-naked women up in the pool. And hold this Mac 10 that's all covered in jewels. And can you please put your titties closer to the 22s? And where's the champagne? We need champagne. Now look as hard as you can with this blunt in your hand. And now hold up your chain, slow motion through the flames. Now cue the smoke machines and the simulated rain. But not too loud cause the baby's sleeping. I wonder if it knows what the world is keeping. Up both sleeves while he lay there dreaming. Me and my robot tiptoe round creeping. I had to turn my back on what got you paid. I couldn't see, had the hood on me like Abu Ghraib. But I like to thank the streets that drove me crazy. And all the televisions out there that breaks me. I was
daydream.
There are a lot of artists who say that hip-hop is dead, that it's just an outmoded art form. What do you think?
I don't think hip-hop is dead, but I think hip-hop has killed a lot of people. You know? I think that hip-hop is what you make it. You can put an infrared beam on it and load it with hollow tips and ride around with a ski mask on and shoot people with it. I think you can put it in a condom and fornicate with prostitutes and video girls. Or I think you can write the Bible on it and write the Quran on it and write the Torah on it and teach from it. You know, it's all on how you do it. But I don't think it's dead. It's never going to die.
Lupe Fiasco's debut album is called Food and Liquor. It reached number one on the rap album charts. And Lupe Fiasco was nominated for 3 2007 Grammy Awards, including Best Rap Album and Best Rap Song. And Strange Champ spoke with him. If you'd like to hear the complete version of Lupe Fiasco's song Muhammad Walks, or listen to the extended version of this interview, go to our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, historian Elaine Pagels on how the Gospel of Judas changes what we know about early Christianity. Also, writer Anne Lamott. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Rockefeller. First Ed.
Judas was the disciple who betrayed Jesus, selling his life for 30 pieces of silver. If there is an arch villain in the story of Jesus, it's Judas Iscariot. Or is it? The newly discovered Gospel of Judas suggests that Judas was, in fact, the favorite disciple, the only one Jesus trusted to carry out his final command, to hand him over to the Romans. So, what should we make of this story? That's the question Elaine Pagels and Karen King pose in their book Reading Judas. Both are renowned historians of the Gnostic Gospels. They say the Gospel of Judas was probably written within the first century after the death of Jesus. It was a terrible time to be a Christian. Many people were killed if they admitted to the Roman authorities that they were, in fact, Christian. Martyrdom, then, became a pivotal idea in the early history of Christianity. And that may be the key to unlocking the mystery behind the Gospel of Judas, as Steve Paulson found out when he talked with Elaine Pagels.
Does this Gospel of Judas reveal something new about early Christianity?
Yes, the Gospel of Judas really has been a surprise in many ways. There's no other text that suggests that Judas Iscariot was an intimate, trusted disciple, one to whom Jesus revealed the secrets of the kingdom, and that the other disciples, conversely, were misunderstanding what he meant by the gospel. So that's quite startling.
That's shocking. I mean, the suggestion is Judas wasn't just one of the disciples. He was actually the favorite disciple of Jesus.
That's right. And also the idea that he had handed Jesus over to be arrested at the orders of Jesus. That is, that this wasn't a betrayal at all. In fact, it was obedience to a command that Jesus had made or a request.
But how do we square this then with all the other stories that we've ever heard about Judas? He's the symbol of treachery and betrayal.
Well, that's right. You know, he has become the symbol of treachery and betrayal. But once you start to look at the Gospels one by one and you realize that's how they were written, you realize that when followers of Jesus were trying to understand what had happened, you know, when Jesus was arrested and killed, they knew that Judas had handed him over to the people who arrested him. And the earliest Gospel, Mark, says just that. You know, Judas handed him over. Doesn't give any motive at all. The people who wrote after Mark, Matthew and Luke's Gospel, which both use all of Mark's Gospel and add material to it, both of those authors apparently felt that what was wrong with the Gospel of Mark was that there was no motive. So Matthew adds a motive. Matthew says that Judas went to the chief priests, whom he knew were Jesus' enemies, and said, "What will you give me if I hand him over to you?" And so they agree on a certain sum of money. So obviously, in Matthew's view, the motive was greed. In Luke's gospel, it's entirely different. It says that the power of evil took Judas over. Satan entered into him. And Luke, I think, is trying to struggle with the question, well, if he's the Son of God, how could he be taken by a mere trick, by a human being? And Luke is trying to show that actually all evil power was concentrated in Judas. So they're very different stories. However, in other gospels, like in John's, those authors suggest that Jesus not only anticipated what was going to happen, but initiated it. The Gospel of John says that he told Judas to go out and do what he had to do, which Jesus, according to the Gospel of John, knew was to betray him. So the Gospel of Judas just takes the suggestion one step further, that Jesus not only knew what was going to happen, but sort of initiated the action.
There's something else that's striking about this Gospel of Judas. He comes across as being very angry, and he's especially angry at the other disciples.
Yes, and you know, that's where we realized, you see, that it's not just a story about Jesus and the disciples. It's a story about the follower of Jesus, the Christian who's writing the story, maybe 60 years after the death of Jesus. And the person who's writing this Gospel of Judas, whoever he is, even using the name of Judas, is a slap in the face, right, to the tradition. You realize that whoever wrote it was a very angry person. And we were trying to say, well, what's going on here? Why is he so angry? We discovered here that one of the main issues is that it's very dangerous to be a follower of Jesus in the generations after his death. You know that Peter, his disciple, was crucified upside down, they say, and Paul was probably beheaded by the Romans, and James was lynched by a crowd, and so were his followers Stephen and others. So leaders of this movement were in great danger, and other Christians were also in danger of being arrested and killed because they followed Jesus. Now, what does a person do in that situation? You know, the question for many of them became, what do you do if you're arrested?
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you acknowledge that you're a Christian, which is probably going to kill you?
Exactly. And all you have to do is say no, you know, or if people are persecuting, you can try to escape or you can bribe them. And many did. So there are many responses to that. The only answer that most Christians agreed was right was you say, yes, I'm a Christian, you defy them, and you go heroically into the lions, you know, or whatever. So we've always thought of Christianity as a religion that glorifies martyrdom. Now we realize that we've had that impression because the people who weren't in favor of martyrdom had their writings buried and burned and trashed and ridiculed. And they were called cowards and heretics and so forth. And the Gospel of Judas is a kind of protest literature. It's challenging leaders of the church. Here they're sort of personified in the disciples, who are encouraging people to get themselves killed, to sort of die for God, as they called martyrdom. Challenging them and saying, you know, when you encourage young people to go out there and die for God, you're really complicit in murder.
I'm wondering if there are some theological issues at stake here. I mean, it gets to the whole role of suffering and the nature of evil as well.
It does, you know, and this is at a time, of course, when any followers of Jesus were trying to struggle with the question of, well, why did Jesus die? What does it all mean? And as you know, in the New Testament, the letters of Paul and the Gospels say, well, why did Jesus die? He died as a sacrifice, like those sacrifices in Jerusalem, like the animals that were slaughtered. Why? Well, to save us from sin. Isn't that the usual answer?
Mm-hmm.
And this author is saying, wait a minute. If you think God wants his son to be tortured and killed before he'll forgive people their sins, what kind of God do you have in mind? You know, is this the God who didn't want animals to be sacrificed in the temple anymore? So this author is saying, isn't God a loving father? Isn't that what Jesus taught? So why are we saying that God requires his son to die for the sins of the world? So it's a challenge to the whole idea of atonement and the idea that Christians, when they worship, eat bread, drink wine as if it were the body and blood of Christ. I mean, this person sees that whole thing as a celebration of violence.
Well, you can see why some of the other early Christians would have attacked this gospel. I mean, this is very threatening to other versions of Christianity of why Jesus died.
Well, to the reasons most Christians give for why Jesus died, this text actually gives different suggestions about that, you know, which is really interesting. As you say, it contradicts everything we know about Christianity, but there's a lot we don't know about Christianity. What we don't know is that there are different ways of understanding the death of Jesus, different ways of interpreting the message that have been actually buried and suppressed.
Well, can you put this Gospel of Judas in perspective for us, and maybe alongside some of the other Gospels that have come to light in recent decades, particularly the Gnostic texts, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene? Do these really change our understanding of early Christianity?
What these do is, it's like, before we had a puzzle with just a few pieces, you know. Now we have many more pieces. We begin to see that the early Christian movement was one in which people talked about and discussed and struggled with all the issues that we think of now as normative Christianity. Like, you know, what does the death of Jesus mean? If we're going to think it has a meaning, then how do we interpret the meaning of that death of Jesus? I mean, this text says Jesus comes to heal and save us because God loves us and delivers us from suffering and sin and from the pain that we experience and actually from death. So it's quite a different perspective. What it shows us is that there wasn't one kind of understanding of Jesus and his message in the early Christian movement. There were actually many.
Now, in recent years, there's been a huge debate over what to make of the Gnostic Gospels, and plenty of Christian scholars and theologians say there's good reason they didn't make it into the Bible. They say the Bible presents the most reliable story of Jesus based on eyewitness accounts. For instance, Ben Witherington has written, and I'm quoting here, "The four canonical Gospels have stood the test of time, and other apocryphal Gospels and texts have not." And he says, "This is because the canonical Gospels are our earliest Gospels and have actual historical substance, while the later Gospels have none."
Well, Witherington has a particular point of view to prove there. I would say that it's very hard to date these other texts. Some of them are as early, certainly historically, as the Gospels of the New Testament, like the Gospels of John. But what's different is sometimes the emphasis. You know, they're not even radically opposed. But let me give you an example. The Gospel of Thomas speaks of Jesus as the light of the world and says that all who recognize that they come from God, that God is the creator of all being, recognize that they are also children of God. And it's instead of a teaching that Jesus is the only Son of God through whom one must be saved, it's a teaching that is akin to, say, what the Quakers teach and some other kinds of Christian groups, including some Greek and Russian Orthodox groups, which is that the divine is to be found in everyone and that we can discover at some level that we're like Christ. It's not necessarily a complete contradiction.
But aren't there crucial doctrinal issues at stake here in terms of what it means to be a Christian? For instance, whether Jesus was the Son of God and whether the return of Jesus was an actual resurrection of the flesh.
Yes. I mean, in the 4th century, the Council of Nicaea established certain doctrines, and they said, this is what it means to be Orthodox. You know, I believe in one God, Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and so forth, and one Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, and so forth. That is, that Jesus Christ is the only one who brings salvation to the whole world. There are, of course, Christians who say, well, I believe in Jesus, but I've also wondered whether people can't find God in other religions, if they're Jews, if they're Muslims, if they're Buddhists, and so forth. There's nothing Jesus himself said that contradicts that, as far as I can see. But 4th century Christianity and what we call Orthodoxy did set out the doctrines you're talking about.
Elaine Pagels, talking with Steve Paulson. Pagels is the co-author with Karen King of the book Reading Judas. If you'd like to read Steve's extended interview with Pagels that ran in Salon Magazine, you'll find it on our website at ttbook.org.
It ain't necessarily so. It ain't necessarily so. The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so.
Yes, Jonah, he lived in the well. Oh, Jonah, he lived in the well. But he made his home in that fish abdomen. Oh, Jonah, he lived in the well.
Coming up, best-selling writer Anne Lamott. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Anne Lamott is famous for her intensely personal and very funny style of writing. The personal embarrassments that most of us try to stuff in the closet, she splashes all over her pages, like her history as a drunk and drug addict. and her feelings of shame and inadequacy. So when Lamont writes about finding God, well, let's just say it's not your normal spiritual memoir. Anne Strangechamps recently sat down with Anne Lamott to talk about her latest book. It's called Grace, Eventually.
I was raised by atheists, and not just regular plain old atheists, but my father had been born and raised in Tokyo with Presbyterian missionary parents, and it was a pretty cold household, and so he's always called the Presbyterians God's frozen people, and of all Christians, I think hated them most.
Isn't that what you are?
One of God, yeah, I'm a Presbyterian.
Presbyterian, not a frozen person.
But if you came to our church, it's like it's hilariously warm and sweet and dear and freeform. It's like freeform skating. It's really not heavy doctrinal. It's really about goodness and mercy and service. But I was raised without any training or any problems, really. I was allowed to go to churches and Christian Science services and temple with my friends because I always sought out friends whose family had faith, but no.
So from the time you were little, were you curious about faith?
You know, I remember one of my best friends was named Peggy when I was 6 years old, and they were Catholics. They lived right down the street, and they had hundreds and hundreds of children, and Peggy was my friend. And I remember, first of all, I remember her very, very devout Catholic father just beating her while I was lying in bed with her. We're six-year-old girls, because she had done something in the kitchen that displeased him. Like, hadn't thrown out the apple peels. I remember exactly. Hadn't thrown out the apple peels for a pie we had helped make. But I loved going to church with them. And I went a lot of Sundays because I love the ritual. I love the incense. I love the words of sweetness and peace. And the Jesus part didn't really throw me. I just wanted to know more. Then later after that, I'd gone to college, not for very long, at Goucher in Maryland. I'd had a really defining experience that I wrote about in Traveling Mercies when my professor, Eva Gossman, took us through Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling, the point of the essay being you were just not going to know this side of the grave, whether there was a God or not. And it was the story of Abraham making the leap of faith when he's been asked to take beautiful, precious Isaac up onto the mountain and sacrifice him. And Isaac is saying, where are we going? Where are we going? And he's saying, Abraham's saying, we're going to sacrifice a lamb, because he's made the leap of faith and he's decided to follow God no matter what, since he and Isaac are so doomed if there's no God. And of course, when they get to the mountain, there are lambs in the thicket and the angels tell Abraham, you have done a beautiful thing in your faith and trust. Now, I've got to say—
But do you like that story?
No,
I hate that story.
I really have to say—
That's one of the reasons I have Christianity. How can you worship a God like that?
I would agree that I hate the story, but I love the Kierkegaard take on it. I have nothing but problems with the Old Testament. All I can say is that when Eva Gossman took me through the very profound and weird and quirky Kierkegaard take on it, I made a decision to do the leap of faith and to just cross over and become a person, a seeker. Hmm. So I was 18.
You have a lovely essay in your new book, Grace, Eventually. You must have been a very young woman and having a kind of rough summer and spending one whole afternoon reading some essays by Ram Dass. And
yeah,
it sounds like that was another moment of awakening.
Well, it's sort of a funny story because it happened to be just a horrendous Sunday when I had this man I loved and he loved me, but he also loved this other woman and she had everything I didn't have, with like enormous breasts and a pretty name, and she wasn't a falling down drunk and drug addict, which I thought gave her an unfair advantage over me. And also I loved him more than she did. So that was another, like,
count against you.
Yeah, another, yeah. So I had, when we had gone to bed the night I spent with him, I hadn't been able, we hadn't seen each other for months, and then things with his other girlfriend had cooled, and we were back together, and we'd had a perfect night. And I saw this book by a guy I'd never heard of, Ram Dass, who turned out to be Richard Alpert, who did the LSD experiments at Harvard with Tim Leary, who I consider a truly dangerous person on this funny blue marble we live on. But anyway, Ram Dass wasn't. He was a gentle, very neurotic, very Jewish Boston Brahmin and had gone to India to seek enlightenment and had found a beautiful teacher named Karoli Baba. So there were these essays from the Menninger Foundation. I just picked them up when I couldn't sleep, and it turned out that she, my competitor, had given them to him, and she'd signed it, and she'd even drawn this little drawing of Krishna. Like, bore me later. Like, what can you say in the face of that? So I put the book down with contempt. And then in the morning, I so wanted to be with him. And it turned out he was going to go to a beautiful outdoor luncheon at the house she owned. And I mean, I literally lived on air. I was a writer. I taught tennis and cleaned houses. And I was so less than. And I so compared my insides with her outsides and really came up short. And I pretended I was sick so I could stay there. And he said, you can stay here, but I won't be back today. And I was so lost, that when he left, I just was crying. And I finally picked up this book, and it was like someone had thrown the switch on. And I started to read it, and I said, uh-oh, my God. Because what I felt like was, me too. Someone is as nuts and sensitive and neurotic and smart and screwed up as I am. And he's found this way of understanding God and human consciousness and suffering and spirituality in a way. He's talking for me. Mm. That was when the plates of the earth shifted beneath me and I could be in, because somebody else as wild as me was in.
Why do you think it is that so many of those transcendent moments when we, you know, feel, how did you write about it, the hole in the cocoon, with those moments of awakening, why is it that those only seem to happen when we're, you know, on our knees? I mean, when something really terrible is also going on, when we feel as bad as it seems possible to feel?
Well, St. John the Divine, of course, writes about the dark night of the soul. And I think it's because when we really hit some kind of a bottom, like people in recovery would understand, when you're deteriorating faster than you can lower your standards, and you've completely run out of good ideas on how to proceed, something happens, which is that we tumble or fall into the abyss that many of us have spent our entire lives avoiding. And finally, you can't go on anymore. You become, you know, it's like a Samuel Beckett character where you're there when you're pawing through your purse looking for something of meaning, and that's when you fall in the abyss. Well, the American tradition is to trick out the abyss more nicely, maybe buy some cuter curtains from IKEA and a rug from Cost Plus and try to make it seem like it's not all that bad. But if you're lucky and you hit hard enough, you don't even have the energy, and in my case, the money, to go to IKEA for the curtains. And, you know, they call it an abyss for a reason. It's abysmal. It's dark and it's often cold and it's scary. And in that time, I think you finally surrender.
There's a tension in, well, especially in Christianity, I think, because there's this notion of suffering and that grace comes out of suffering. Can't that so easily turn into a great
martyrdom?
Yeah,
and fundamentalism and Shiite madness. Well, yeah, I mean, and I always have said that you can tell you've created God in your own image when he hates all the same people you do. And I think that's what happens, you know, and I think that it's the scariest thing of all is, you know, the opposite of faith is not doubt, it's certainty. I think it's the scariest position to be in, is to be sure that you're right.
How did Jesus come into your life?
Well, this was an accident, I want to say. And, I was drinking, and over-serving myself on a daily basis and taking pills to help me with either the exhaustion or the mania. And I used to go over to the flea market in my little community, and I would hear the music wafting over from this crummy-looking little church. Talk about Beckett. It looked like, I mean, it had that little tree that we see at the end of Waiting for Godot, where the grace is represented by three leaves on the trees. It hadn't been there when the play opens. They're like three leaves on the tree, and I like that in a church. I like ramshackle and buckle and sag, because it seems like it might be a place that would be glad that I was there. I wasn't hearing gospel. What I was hearing was basically the soundtrack of the civil rights movement, and the soundtrack of all those peace marches I went to as a teenager when we were in Vietnam and Cambodia. All the songs Pete Seeger and Joan Baez and Mahalia Jackson had sung. I just went in because I had run out of good ideas. And there weren't very many people. There may be 40, and they didn't even have pews. I just sat down because I liked the music. And then they did the most important thing I think you can offer people who are lost, which is they didn't hassle me to death. They didn't come up and want to come visit me, which, have, believe me, I would have run screaming for my cute little life if they had tried to sign me up or for Bible study or help me understand doctrine, the, you know, the triune nature of the God.
Where did Jesus come in?
Well, so they're Christians, so they were talking about Jesus as the person from whom they heard this, from whom they heard that they were supposed to ease the suffering, and that Jesus doesn't mention sex, for instance. There's nothing about sex. There's nothing about gays. There's nothing about not being married, you know, living with somebody you love. There's not any information about who you are allowed to love or be loved by. So they were talking about what Jesus tells us, which is feed my sheep, you know, take care of the hungry, that Jesus will be where the least of his people are, that if you want to be with Jesus, go hang out with the desperately poor. You want to feel his love, go to the prisons. He'd been a prisoner. Go sit down with the prisoners. You know, that they are the least of his people are so precious to him, and he will be especially close to them. And I heard that. I often left for the sermon in my first year because the Jesus part was definitely a fly in the ointment for me, you know. I mean, even though these people were Christians, but I heard something, you know. I heard something so deep under the rubble that I thought was dead. And so after a year, for some reason that I will never explain, I said, okay, whatever, I'm in. And I got sober a year later after that. So I converted drunk. Mm-hmm. And people can say whatever they want about that. But I know that I experienced Jesus as sort of a funny little presence, like a little feral kitten or something running by my feet. And I didn't want a little kitten at the time. And I'm not stupid. I know that if you feed them or even pet them, you suddenly have a feral little kitten. And finally, one day, at the very, very bottom of my cycle of my life, I said, okay, you can come in. And I said to Jesus, fine, whatever. But it was mostly that the people there let me be and let me find my way. And for some reason, the people at that little church and the preachers at that little church and the music we sing and the service that those people do spoke to me.
Anne Lamott talked with Anne Strangechamps. Lamott's latest book is called Grace Eventually, Thoughts on Faith. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. Send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Getting Religion, number 624A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strangechamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.